At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Unless you're a real junkie of American political history, the name Cary Estes Kefauver probably doesn't mean a lot to you. He was a politician from Tennessee. So why are we talking about him on a Miami podcast? Because Estes Kefauver once ran to be the president of the United States. And his platform for doing so was leading a crime commission. And that crime commission placed its focus on the mob. And in the 1930s and 1940s, there was arguably no place in America more mobbed up than Miami. As we've mentioned previously on this podcast, perhaps the best known mobster in American history, Al Capone, died in Miami Beach in 1947. So when the Special Committee to Investigate Organized Crime in Interstate Commerce, co-chaired by Herbert R. O'Connor of Maryland, Charles W. Toby of New Hampshire, and, most famously, Estes Kefauver of Tennessee, decided to start going after urban centers that featured mob crime, the first city they would come to was Miami. Today, this day in Miami history, May 26th, 1950, when the Kefauver Committee came to South Florida and began asking questions that no one really wanted to answer.
The high times and low times, all in the nightlife. I am a surprise, we'll open your eyes. But when the day breaks, you feel the sun kiss. If it's paradise, oh, what you wish.
The Kefauver Commission was very much not the first effort to root out the mob in Miami-Dade County. Again, when Al Capone came to Miami in the 1920s, there were multiple efforts from municipalities throughout the region to attempt to push him out, yet he made friends and was able to find his way to Palm Island for decades. By the 1940s, the organized effort to combat organized crime had a name. It started as the Secret Six, described here in Season 2, Episode 3 of Magic City by the fictional character Meg Bannock, describing a very real thing.
Oh, yes, he started the Secret Six.
Secret Six? Never heard of that.
Hence, secret. My father got the owners of the Herald, the News, of our biggest radio station, a few bankers, the six men who run Miami, to join together and finally stop those gangsters.
How?
Every week they put one of those rats in the front page of the paper, a big picture, give their names, addresses, what crimes they were committing here every week, right there for the city to see.
The only real factual inaccuracy there is that there were no bankers involved. It was the Herald and the Daily News, James L. Knight, the publisher of the Herald, and Dan Mahoney, the publisher of the Daily News, as well as Frank Kazantine, who's the owner of WKAT, McGregor Smith, who's president of Florida Power and Light at the time, and George Witten, who was the principal owner of Burdines, John Clark, principal owner of the Hialeah Racetrack. The Secret Six worked together for a few years and eventually combined with the Dade County Bar Association to form a public group instead of operating in private. This group came to be known as the Crime Commission of Greater Miami. One of this public group's first official acts was to hire an experienced investigator to go after organized crime. They found former FBI agent Daniel P. Sullivan. Sullivan knew organized crime, knew the underworld, had tracked down John Dillinger and Ma Barker, and he intended to go after what he saw as organized crime and its pervasive effects in South Florida. The problem for the group was that it was not actually a law enforcement agency per se. It could investigate, but had no power to arrest, charge, or punish. And so making the public aware of who was involved in what was the most powerful thing that the Crime Commission could do. The Herald and the Daily News plastered pictures, put addresses, described activities. Sullivan himself appeared on WKAT and produced a radio segment known as The Sinister Blot, describing activities of the criminal underworld in Miami. It was all designed to raise public awareness, which was then designed to raise the awareness of elected officials and police. The problem was that there were plenty of law enforcement officials in South Florida perfectly happy with the arrangement, as the Crime Commission and Estes Kefauver would soon find out. Ultimately, it was the work of the Crime Commission and testimony by Sullivan to the United States Senate that motivated Kefauver, a relatively new senator at the time, to join and ultimately lead a new commission on organized crime. Kefauver was motivated, but the rest of the United States Senate wasn't necessarily the same level of enthused about a probe of organized crime. In the days leading up to the vote on whether a special commission would be created, a shocking story out of Kansas City helped to change the math. On the night of April 6, 1950, Charles Bonaggio and his associate, Charles Mad Dog Gargatta, were both shot down in Kansas City, Missouri. Now, both of these men being the victim of an assassin were not surprising. They were involved with, and Bonaggio was the head of the Kansas City mob. But what was interesting is that Bonaggio was also the head of a new political machine, challenging the established political machine of Tom Pendergrast in Missouri. The intertwining of organized crime and politics, particularly in Kefauver's party, the Democratic Party, was notable. Now, the current president at the time was Harry S. Truman of Missouri. He was not part of the Bonaggio machine. He was a supporter of Pendergrast. But it created a lot of awkward circumstances among members of the United States Senate and the House. Ultimately, a tie-breaking vote needed to be cast in the Senate to create a joint committee led by Estes Kefauver. Vice President Alvin Barker broke that tie and, according to the language of the law, would be responsible for picking the five members of this joint committee, including members from both the Committee on the Judiciary and the Committee on Commerce. Kefauver would lead the five. Even before the committee officially got underway, Kefauver was doing some intelligence work in South Florida. He visited early in 1950 and told the Miami Herald, quote, "Let's get rid of those Miami rascals," speaking of the organized crime faction in South Florida. He said of Miami, quote, "That's too nice a place to louse up." The mob was the focus, but one very specific part of their criminal activity was going to be put under the microscope, and that's gambling. Now, by 1950, some gambling was allowed in Florida, specifically horse racing, dog racing, and hi-a-lay. Slot machines had been legalized in 1945 and then made illegal again in 1937. So if you wanted to go to Tropical Park Racecourse and place a bet, Hialeah Racecourse, place a bet, or the Fronton in Miami, you were perfectly fine to do that. But that was small potatoes compared to the big money that was available if you were able to book bets from people outside of the state of Florida, in states where gambling was illegal. And that, according to Kefauver, according to the Greater Miami Crime Commission, was where the mob stepped in, utilizing telephone and telegraph to communicate racing information across the country to satisfy bets. The names that appeared on Kefauver's list to focus on included, but were not limited to, Charlie Fischetti, Vincent Allo, also known as Joe Dodo, Trigger Mike Coppola, Willie Weisberg, and the two biggest names, Frank Costello and Meyer Lansky. There were dozens of more figures that either worked directly in South Florida or came for a nice winter. Either way, the passing of information across state lines to facilitate gambling was a federal crime. not to mention the numerous bets that were placed at hotels and other facilities in South Florida that weren't authorized to host gambling. This was an insidious operation that had infiltrated all parts of South Florida life, including its law enforcement. In particular, the S&G Corporation, or the S&G Syndicate, was under the microscope. Jules Levitt, Sam Cohen, Eddie Rosenbaum, Harold Salvey, and Charles Friedman were five independent bookmakers in the 1940s who came together to form this operation and attempt to entirely control local gambling in South Florida. And they largely did, with the understanding and sometimes cooperation of the Miami Beach Police Department and the Dade County Sheriff's Office. This intertwinedness was what Kefauver was going to tee off on, an attempt to not only go after the mob itself, but the elected officials that facilitated them. One specific example that was later uncovered is the fact that New York gambler Frank Erickson attempted to make inroads at the Roney Plaza Hotel on Miami Beach and paid the hotel $45,000 for a 3-month bookie concession. When it was discovered, Miami Beach police raided the hotel and forced Erickson to leave town. Not with the intent of actually prosecuting him, but ensuring that the S&G Syndicate would retain control of the Roney Plaza. The talk was in place for weeks, but when was the action? Well, it was on May 26th and May 27th of 1950. Kefauver and members of the commission came into Dade County, essentially in full secrecy, attempting not to tip their hand. This committee hearing was not going to be publicized. It was not going to be open to the public. It was going to be an attempt by Kefauver and his men to get in, to get out, and to, as quickly as possible, build a record of an organization with national influence, but with a particular focus on Dade and Broward counties. 16 witnesses ultimately testified to the committee over 2 days, responding to subpoenas. This included alleged members of the mob, like John F. O'Rourke, who was the boss of interstate operations in West Palm Beach. He was asked about connections with Mickey Cohen of Los Angeles and Frank Erickson and Joe Adonis of New York. There were also public officials who were called to testify, including Sheriff Walter Clark of Broward County. Clark was the first in a line of public officials who were asked by this committee on their wealth. Where did they get their money from? How much were they worth? And how would that jibe with whatever their annual pay as an elected official or a public official would be? According to the Miami News, Clark couldn't remember how much property he owned, nor what his approximate wealth was. This was the connecting point to build the relationship, according to the committee, figuring out how people entrusted by the public to administer funds and execute the law were potentially being corrupted by gambling money.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.
Perhaps the most notable example of this was an official who didn't testify to the committee, James A. Sullivan, who was the sheriff of Dade County. When the committee first attempted to bring him in for questioning in May of 1950, he did not respond to the subpoena, saying that he was fishing. Between the committee's arrival in May 1950 and the end of the year, he was eventually suspended by the governor of the state of Florida, because he had been charged with bribery and racketeering, not to mention neglect of duty and incompetence. But the governor that suspended the sheriff had his own problems. Fuller Warren had been under accusation from Dan Sullivan for years following the 1948 gubernatorial campaign, in which Warren received more than $400,000 from Lewis Wolfson, C.V. Griffin, and William H. Johnson, who all were involved in dog tracks in South Florida, as well as an Illinois horse racing track. Sullivan believed that these men were in on the racket, and that Warren used his power in the governor's mansion to slow down or stop entirely investigations that would prove it. Kefauver took these allegations from Sullivan seriously, so much so that they appeared in detail in the final Kefauver Commission report. Warren was very eager to challenge Kefauver and his findings.
Debate Senator Kefauver face to face without restriction on this subject. And if he has any feeling that he would like to meet me in joint debate, I'd be glad to meet him any place he names, but I would want the debate unrestricted, and I want an opportunity to present all that I have to say, and I would want him to have an opportunity to present all that he has.
Warren's wording there implies that Kefauver didn't want to hear from him. In fact, he did. He gave him multiple opportunities to testify to the full committee under oath. This included a subpoena that was issued for him to testify in Washington, D.C., which Warren rejected as a violation of state sovereignty. Then, Kefauver offered to hear his testimony under oath in Tallahassee. Warren countered with an offer of a, quote, conference, with no oath being sworn. Kefauver wanted the record to be under oath, so that if there were any lies told, perjury could be charged. And because this was not provided, Kefauver eventually stopped requesting testimony from Warren. Ultimately, what made the Kefauver Commission notable was not what happened in Miami, although Miami played a critical role. The traveling show of the Kefauver Commission didn't just visit South Florida. It visited a variety of cities, including Kansas City, the political home of the president, as well as New York. And as the committee traveled, it began to make its work public. It began to call witnesses and force them to answer questions publicly, under oath, and critically, on television. This was the first major televised congressional committee hearing that most Americans ever saw, and it became a sensation. By the time the committee reached New York in 1951, the Kefauver Commission was one of the most watched television events of all time to that point. The highlight was the testimony of the aforementioned Frank Costello.
You are Frank Costello?
Yes, sir.
No. You solemnly swear the testimony to give this committee shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
Costello was a legitimate figure in the world of the mob. His nickname was the Prime Minister. He worked within the Luciano crime family. And now he was sitting in front of members of the United States Senate and answering questions on live television.
What is your net worth?
I refuse to answer. It might intend to incriminate me.
The committee directs that you do answer, and are we to understand that his
direction is made and a refusal is made?
Right.
I suppose so. Is that not so, Mr.
Yes.
All right. Next question.
Costello testified to that committee on March 15, 1951, almost a year after the Miami hearings, and the final report would be issued on August 31, 1951. It was a revelation. The extent to which the report was able to show the American public how the mob had influenced just interstate gaming really forced the American public to be more aware of what the mob was doing and forced Congress to take action. The voices you will hear here are first of Walter Cronkite reporting for his show, The 20th Century, and secondly, of Senator Estes Kefauver.
What federal legislation actually came out of this hearing, Senator?
Well, a great many enactments. We strengthened the narcotic laws, we changed the deportation laws so that some of the worst criminals have been deported. We amended the Internal Revenue Code, and the Internal Revenue Department set up a special criminal tax squad. They made 46,000 investigations, brought about 1,800 cases. These involved some $250 million. Then we were able to do away through the FCC with the nationwide wire service, the gambling wire service that held all of these gangs together, the nucleus of them. And of course, that service has not been reestablished. These are just a few of the things that were done.
Despite Miami's lesser known first position, in the order of events. Keith Oliver and his commission made a serious impact on South Florida. Even years later, in December of 1952, people in Miami-Dade County, then Dade County, young people, wanted to know about Keith Oliver and his influence and whether he would continue to be on the case when it came to pursuing the mob. This is from the NBC program Youth Wants to Know.
That says, I've just returned from a brief visit to that magical city, Miami, where I visited their superb television station. You appeared on the WTVJ, and their newscaster, yeah, Ralph Rennick, told me to ask you about rumors that gambling will soon be wide open again in Florida, now that your committee is out of there. What do you think about those rumors?
Ted, I hadn't heard the rumors, but I was in Florida not long ago myself. Of course, I wasn't there on any matter having to do about crime. I was there during the presidential campaign. And I found there at that time that the situation in Dade County in Miami Beach, was very much better than it's been in a long time. They have a good sheriff and a very good police department. People are continuing their interest. The Miami Crime Committee is continuing to do good work. So I would doubt if the people of Miami or that section would permit any reopening of big-time gambling.
Keith Oliver mentioned there the presidential election of 1952. You may not have heard his name before the episode today, but it's really important to recognize how this commission made Estes Keith Oliver a star, arguably the first celebrity politician from television. He was so popular that he appeared as a celebrity guest on the new game show What's My Line, talking about the hearings in late 1951, and then decided in 1952 to challenge President Harry S. Truman for the nomination of the Democratic Party in that year. Now, Truman had served one full term from 1948 and had taken over for President Franklin Delano Roosevelt upon his death in April 1945, so he had been president for nearly 8 years. However, the newly ratified 22nd Amendment didn't apply to Truman because he was holding office when it went into effect, and there were specific language in the amendment that ensured that Truman, if he wanted to pursue a third term, could. And, as of early 1952, he did. But by the end of March 1952, his opinion changed, and he dropped out of the race. This happened in between.
It was the nation's first presidential primary, and a record one. And when the ballots were totted up, it was a clean sweep for General Eisenhower on the Republican side and for Senator Estes Keith Oliver heading the Democratic slate. New Hampshire has spoken, and experts are looking for more straws in the political wind.
Keith Oliver beat Truman in New Hampshire. Now, in fairness to President Truman, he wasn't really directly campaigning in New Hampshire, and Keith Oliver was, but that wasn't the point. The president, if he wanted it, should have been able to win the primary, and he didn't, so he dropped out. Now, in his memoirs after the fact, Truman said, I wanted to drop out well before New Hampshire, I just hadn't announced it, but New Hampshire was certainly the final nail in the coffin of the Truman administration, at least politically. Keith Oliver took the momentum from his convention, and he landed a win in New Hampshire. And he took the momentum from his win in New Hampshire and became the polling favorite among Democrats to be the nominee in 1952. He went from 21% of support in February 52 to 33% in April, and by July 1952, he had 45% of the support of polled Democrats, according to Gallup. There was only one problem. Primaries and polls did not determine the nominee in 1952. State conventions still did. State conventions across the country, often led by party bosses. Party bosses that were not too happy with what Estes Keith Oliver had done to both the mob and elected politicians who were part of party machines in 1950 and 1951. When he went to the convention floor in Chicago in late July 1952, he didn't stand a chance. Eventually, Adlai Stevenson of Illinois was picked as a consensus candidate, and Keith Oliver was pushed to the side. Keith Oliver would eventually become the vice presidential nominee for Stevenson in 1956, but Stevenson was destined to lose both in 1952 and 1956 to Dwight D. Eisenhower. Despite the setbacks in 52 and 56, he still appeared to have a long political career ahead of him. However, on August 8, 1963, Kefauver suffered a heart attack on the floor of the Senate, attempting to add an antitrust provision into a NASA appropriations bill. He went to Bethesda Naval Hospital for treatment, but 2 days later suffered an aortic aneurysm and died in his sleep. Estes Kefauver never became president, never became vice president. But no matter what, his impact on the awareness of the mob among the American public and the way in which his committee revolutionized the way that Congress communicated to the general public through television still affects us to this day. Just turn on C-SPAN or any news channel, and any sort of committee activity you see going on, you can trace its legacy to Estes Kefauver and the United States Senate Special Committee to Investigate Crime in Interstate Commerce, and its first hearing outside of D.C. in Miami. A lot of sources to thank on this episode, so I'll try to make it snappy. First off, as always, the Wolfson Archive at Miami-Dade College and newspapers.com. A variety of video sources are available on YouTube, and I will do my best to share those on our website, thisdaymiamipod.com. There's a great book called Organized Crime in Miami by Avi Bash, and the information I got in the S&G Syndicate was really helpful from there. The Dade County State Attorney's Office has records of the grand juries back in the 40s and the 50s. That was incredibly helpful in the preparation of this episode, as well as the actual United States Senate website and its record of the Kefauver Commission. All of that was incredibly helpful. This is our second episode this month. We were out in April due to illness, so I wanted to make it right and present a second episode here in May. But we hope to get back to the one episode a month rhythm next month in June. Before then, though, please make sure you visit our website, thisdaymiamipod.com. You can find our entire backlog of old episodes, as well as a variety of transcripts and other information on episodes, social media, pretty much every social media platform at This Day Miami Pod. That's Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Be sure to follow us there and follow us on your preferred podcast provider, Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever it may be. We have an RSS feed. If you prefer that, you can find it on our website and upload it to your podcast player there. If you have any questions about episodes or if you have ideas for new episodes, you can always comment on social media or email us thisdaymiamipod@gmail.com. I think that's all the business for now. As always, thank you so much for listening, and until next time, I've been Matthew Bunch. The high times and low times, all in the night life. I am a surprise. We'll open your eyes. But when the day breaks, you feel the sun kiss. If it's paradise, oh, what you wish.
At Verizon, anyone can trade in their old phone for a new one on us with Unlimited Ultimate, which means everyone in your family could get a new phone and stay on your family plan, keeping you close.
Hey, Mom, you seen my toothbrush?
Yeah, I'm almost done with it.
Oh, maybe too close. Trade-in and additional terms apply. See Verizon.com for details.